right. It's 5:30 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. It is time for Rockin' the Boat. My name is the V-Man, and today on the program, we'll be talking about imperialism with Richard Falk. He is a prolific writer, speaker, and activist of world affairs, and a visiting professor in the Global Studies program at UC Santa Barbara. He's also the retired Alfred G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. Stand by. The American Heritage Dictionary defines the term imperialism thusly: the policy of extending a nation's authority by territorial acquisition or by the establishment of economic and political hegemony over other nations. The United States military apparatus consists of over 500,000 troops stationed on some 400 bases in at least 35 countries, positioned in strategic locations around the planet. Since World War II, the U.S. government has doled out more than $240 billion in direct military aid to more than 80 countries. This buildup is justified to the American people as necessary to safeguard us from terrorism and to protect the military's host countries from being attacked. But what are the true motivations for this far-flung military presence? Do we live in an age of American empire? Today on Rockin' the Boat, we'll pose these and other questions to my guest, Professor Richard Falk, a prolific writer, speaker, and activist of world affairs. Richard Falk is a visiting professor in the Global Studies program at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and retired Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. He has been on the editorial boards of about 10 journals and magazines, including the American Journal of International Law and The Nation magazine. Richard Falk has also been on the advisory boards of Amnesty International, the Center for International Policy, and currently the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. And he has acted as counsel to Ethiopia and Liberia in the Southwest Africa case before the International Court of Justice. Professor Falk has written extensively on international law and the law of war, and is the author or co-author of more than 20 books, including Indefensible Weapons, The Political and Psychological Case Against Nuclearism, This Endangered Planet, and most recently, The Great Terror War. Richard Falk served on the Independent International Commission on Kosovo from 1999 to 2001, and the UN Human Rights Commission to the Occupied Palestinian Territories. It's a great honor to have you here with us today on Rockin' the Boat, Professor Falk.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, why don't we begin by a little discussion about your most recent book, The Great Terror War. In that book, you make an important distinction between the terms terrorism and what you call megaterrorism. Can you talk about that distinction and why you feel it is important to differentiate the terms?
Well, I think it is extremely relevant to the judgment about the American response to September 11th. What I called megaterrorism there was a new kind of political violence that has a real resemblance to interstate warfare, is able to inflict harm of a severe symbolic and substantive character, seeks goals that are of a very grandiose character, and provides no easy diplomatic solution. Terrorism, as we've previously understood it, is a form of political violence that is directed against civilians and innocent civilians. It's normally associated with those that are engaged in anti-state movements, but in my view, it's much more appropriately viewed in terms of both state terror and anti-state terror. And the characteristic that makes it important to distinguish the two is that this kind of terrorism is susceptible to compromise, diplomacy, some kind of eventual reconciliation, and that there is a specific conflict, usually over territory or self-determination in some form, and therefore it's a negotiable conflict that is within strict limits. One of the great and tragic deficiencies in the American response to September 11th, which is an important part of the argument of my book, is that President Bush, I think, deliberately merged the two kinds of terrorism so as to create a mandate for state terrorism to escalate its reliance on violence. And that has happened not only in the Israel-Palestine relationship, but Russia-Chechnya, China-Xinjiang province, India-Kashmir. And it has also put the United States more or less on a course of perpetual war.
This merging that you're that you just discussed of the two ideologies of megaterrorism and terrorism, is this why you think maybe the general American public is has really refused to ask the question of why in the aftermath of September 11th?
Well, I think some Americans, of course, have asked why. I think the government has used skillfully a mixture of conceptual confusion and fear to create a climate of patriotic fervor that is epitomized by the slogan "United We Stand," which I think is really trying to express the view that any kind of principal disagreement is a form of unpatriotic behavior. And what is really important at this stage is for Americans to realize that patriotism has to do at its best with love of the country and its potential, not what the government professes to be doing, particularly not if the government is doing things that are inconsistent with law and morality.
Let's talk a little bit about the Bush Doctrine. In the aftermath of 9/11, something emerged that we call the Bush Doctrine. That is the idea that nations have this inherent right to offensive defense or to preemptively attack another sovereign nation. The Bush Doctrine also holds that a rejection of American values is akin to being an enemy. But this is really nothing new in regards to the use of military force. You argue the case that the U.S. military is positioned around the globe to defend multinational capital investment from indigenous uprisings, and maybe if you could give our listeners some examples of this, how this has played out in the past.
Well, it depends how far back in the past you mean. During the Cold War era, we're familiar with the interventions in Iran and Guatemala, for instance, in the 1950s, which in both cases disrupted a quite encouraging democratic process in those two countries and substituted very oppressive military regimes. And there was a big economic payoff in both cases. In the Iranian case, the oil companies were privatized, and the American major oil companies gained a dominant control over the Iranian oil industry. In the Guatemalan case, United Fruit was heavily invested there. There's also the Chilean example where Pinochet was overthrown with American encouragement, and that protected the American copper companies that had large investments there, as well as some companies like AT&T that ran the telecommunications industry. So there's been a consistent pattern that has existed during the Cold War, and then in the aftermath of the Cold War, it is certainly seems to be the case that the first Gulf War had as part of its motivation the protection of the Gulf oil framework, and particularly maintaining a relatively low price for oil. It had as a secondary objective the removal of Iraq from Kuwait, but I think the main interest by the United States, and it includes the post-September 11th wars, where both in Afghanistan and now in the Iraq war, the relationship to the crucial energy reserves of the world, which have a geopolitical significance, because it's not only that you control this critical resource, but you also control the politics of the countries that are dependent on the resource. So for the United States to have this dominance in the Middle East and Central Asia means that Europe and Japan are not really able to oppose in any significant way American global policy.
Some have said that Iraq was sort of a key to this new hegemonic sort of position that we're, that the U.S. is taking in the world. What do you think? What are your thoughts on that? Why Iraq?
Well, it's a good question, and the easy answer is that Iraq was a simple way of demonstrating to the world the American imperial design. Iraq had been weakened greatly by 12 years of sanctions and the defeat in the first Gulf War. It had a dictator that was generally hated in the region and around the world. It had important strategic resources, and it was seen as an adversary, potential adversary of Israel, and a psychological support for the sort of violence that was associated with recent Palestinian tactics, including suicide bombings. So that for many reasons, Iraq was the most vulnerable state to this new phase of American global expansionism, and it was an easy kill, so to speak. And that meant that I would add another factor that's important. It gave the United States the opportunity to demonstrate to other countries that it doesn't care about the UN or about international law, that its voice is much louder and much more controlling than is the voice of the international community or of the legal framework.
We're speaking with Richard Falk. He's a visiting professor in the Global Studies program at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and retired Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. This idea you were just talking about, the UN, you're arguing that the framework of debate in the UN is constrained and that the UN has been co-opted by these neoconservative forces who populate the Bush administration. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, I'd reformulate your question a little bit, because it's more than just the Bush administration. It was true before the Bush administration. It was true in the Clinton years that the United States viewed the United Nations as legitimate to the extent that it supported U.S. foreign policy, but no more, and no further than that. And it showed in the Kosovo context that it was prepared to bypass the UN and act under a NATO umbrella, even though that violated the charter, which the UN charter, which requires any use of force not in self-defense be authorized by the Security Council, including action by a regional organization. Now, what the Bush people have done is just push that American effort at the geopolitical control of the UN Security Council a step further and make it somewhat more blatant. In these other instances, the encounter with the UN was disguised to a degree, and therefore it didn't seem as though it was such a clear repudiation. But the hardline neocons that are guiding the Bush foreign policy welcomed the chance to show the United to show both the American people and the world that the United States had the will to act in defiance of the UN Security Council and of world public opinion. And this was partly an exhibition of an imperial identity, that the United States was showing to the world what would happen to a people or a society if they stood in the way of this global imperial design. And in that sense, Iraq was a useful form of geopolitical pedagogy. There's a way of teaching other countries in the world that if they don't conform, they're going to suffer.
I see. So can this be, this is part of the new American imperialism then. How does this imperialism differ from empires of the past?
I think it has several features that set it apart. For one thing, it has a potential global scope. No empire has ever sought to extend its reach to the entire planet so that it would, in a sense, be a borderless empire. Secondly, this is a empire that is powered by a visionary ideology where the combination of religious fervor associated with evangelical Christianity is linked to a neoconservative view of political leadership that sees the American destiny as one of controlling the future of the planet. And it sees it to such an extent that it justifies deceiving the public as necessary in order to carry forward what they seem sincerely to believe is beneficial for the United States and for the world as a whole.
Talk about some of those deceptions and the language that is used to sort of trick the American public.
Well, I think one of the ways that the deception is disseminated is to act as if the United States is not seeking imperial power, but is actually promoting democracy, and that it is championing the democratic destiny of peoples that are living under oppressed circumstances. If one takes note, though, of the concrete meaning of democracy, it's very strange. Paul Wolfowitz lectured the Turkish society because the military didn't override the rejection by the Turkish parliament of the American wish to use Turkish territory to mount a northern front offensive in the Iraq War, even though the Turkish parliament reflected the views of 94% of the Turkish citizenry. So what Wolfowitz was asking the military to do was apparently to intervene in the constitutional life of Turkey, to repudiate the views of the overwhelming majority of its people and of its elected representatives. And that conveys a very strange sense of what democracy means. It's also illustrated by the imposition of Abu Mazen as the Palestinian leader, who is touted as a great improvement over the allegedly autocratic Yasser Arafat. But the indications are that as far as the Palestinian people are concerned, less than 2% endorse Abu Mazen, or sometimes called Mohammed Abbas, as a legitimate leader and representative of the Palestinian people, while at least 21% endorse Arafat in that role. That isn't a great percentage for him either, but it's more than 10 times the support that the American candidate who's supposed to represent democracy is concerned. Another example is what President Bush calls peace. He, in his West Point speech and again in the introduction to the National Security Strategy document of 2002, says that we now have the greatest opportunity to produce peace in the world since the 17th century. And then he goes on to say this peace rests on the United States acquiring such an edge of military dominance that other countries have no incentive to compete with the United States. So it is the peace of imperial subjugation, and it is also a peace in which the rest of the world, in effect, disarms while the United States achieves this total domination that is sustained by military force.
You're tuned to Rockin' the Boat on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm joined by Richard Falk. We have just a few minutes left. Richard, I want you to maybe gaze into your crystal ball and look past beyond the 2004 election. What implications does all this have for the future?
Well, I think it is a great challenge to American society and more widely to the world. I believe that this form of global imperialism, if it isn't checked and effectively resistant, will produce for the first time in human history the phenomenon of global fascism, that is, the linking of military and economic concentration and consolidation of power, reinforced by a visionary ideology and extended to all corners of the world. It's an extremely dangerous prospect, leading to the likely suppression of opposition in this country and to a condition of perpetual war throughout the world, because the rest of the world and much of the United States will not passively accept this transition to global empire and militarism. It will mount various forms of resistance. But because the ideology is so intense on the part of those who are in the Bush entourage, they will spare no means to continue with their project. And it is in that context of imperial ambition and popular resistance that I see a cycle emerging that could eventuate in this most horrifying of phenomena, a new form of fascism that has the world as its political arena.
Michael Parenti, in the closing verses of his classic book, Against Empire, he writes, quote, "Along with all the cruelties and horrors, the history of imperialism is a history of resistance and rebellion, coming sometimes in the most unexpected moments and places." He goes on, but I'm wondering if you could maybe carry on this thought and some strategies for resisting this new emerging global fascism.
Well, I think there it has been emerging in the world a very powerful transnational movement associated with the construction of something people call global civil society. It took its principal form in the 1990s in opposing globalization, producing the Battle of Seattle, and then moving, I think, in more positive directions toward becoming a global democracy movement, a movement that combined an ethics of human solidarity with a commitment to global justice in a number of different areas. And in the 1990s, I think it was making significant progress. There was, for the first time, a move toward imposing accountability on dictators. The Pinochet case stood out in that respect. An international criminal court was established through the joint efforts of moderate governments and social movements around the world. And there was an increasing recognition that the peoples of the world were not represented either in the United Nations or in the international institutions that were governing their economic life. And so there was also a rising demand to create a global people's assembly that would represent people rather than states and resemble, to some extent, the European Parliament that has gradually deepened the democratic experience that European peoples have known in recent years, and creates a sense of shared community that isn't identical with belonging to a single sovereign state, and therefore, I think, creates the sorts of political identities that could underpin a genuine global movement dedicated to change and to resisting militarism and global imperialism.
And that was the voice of Professor Richard Falk, prolific writer, speaker, and activist of world affairs, visiting professor in the Global Studies program at UC Santa Barbara, and retired Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law and Practice at Princeton University. Richard Falk, I want to thank you for joining us tonight on Rockin' the Boat.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And that's going to wrap it up for us tonight. Tune in again on Monday for another edition of the program. I'll be joined by Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. We're going to be discussing the upcoming FCC consolidation hearings. Also next week, I have interviews scheduled with Michael Parenti, and we'll be hearing about the pepper spray case of October 1997 up in Humboldt County. Tune in next week at 5:30 for Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. V-Man signing out.
Here comes a rap song, country song, heavy metal folk song, coming from the well that's fed the prophets writing all along its own, to the highest goal that humankind could want to reach. I come to talk to you, I didn't write this song to preach, so listen close, I ain't verbose like rappers talking hype. My time is far too precious, plus I just plain ain't the type. This song that goes and flows out to all my Americans, North, South, and Central, and my family in Afghanistan, Israelis, Arabs, Europeans, yeah, and Africans. You get the picture, can the strictures keep in peace from being friends? I come to break down borders, redefine the new world order, bleed truth in this recorder, be a global building motor. I have one aim that's plain straight ahead of me, to be a new world order, setting myself free. Yippee-yay, fire raining down from the sky today. Hey, hey, what's that sound? Babylon is falling down, Babylon is falling down. Talking about the world to be, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, getting people all around to stand up for equality. We're free, we be lots of people just like me. That's why we're really freaking out Tom Warner and the FCC. This ain't no kiddie cuss words, but real controversy. Makes the fake cowboys in Congress shake inside their boots. The new world order rips the weeds of lies up by the roots. I guess it's great that their time's late and it's become my fate to write with so much love these words impossible to hate. I scan Will Rogers, Walt Whitman, and Hank Williams too. Two Bobs, Marley, Dylan, Nas, and Ani Mo. Deaf who, but I ain't after being Elvis Presley angrily. I get my words from Jesus Christ, Jalal Adun Rumi. I learned my love from Martin Luther King and from Gandhi, and put it here for years to hear and in the streets to see. I come to break down borders, redefine the new world order, be truth in this recorder, be a global building motor. I have one name that's plain straight ahead of me, to be a newer word, I'm setting myself free.